This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's 5:07, and you're listening to Top 5 at 5 with Sharad and Cam, where we count down to the biggest story of the day. First up,
number 5.
The Women's Ministry reveals that there have been over 1,000 reports of sexual harassment by men.
Women's Minister Datuk Sri Nancy Shukri said that over 1,000 complaints were received from men through the government's social support centres. She said that there were initially a few reports from men, but the introduction of counsellors and active outreach efforts have encouraged more men to speak up about their experiences.
Now, just last month, data from Bukit Aman Sexual, Women's and Child Investigations Department, or D11, showed that there's a steady increase in the number of male victims. In 2023, there were over 3,300 sexual harassment and assault cases. Of these, 4%, about 135 victims, were male. Compared to the figure of about 1,000 reports from the Women's Ministry, this is an increase of over 600%.
D11's Assistant Director, Assistant Commander Siti Kamsia Hassa, said the increase is because of the internet, making it harder for sexual crimes to cross borders and reach a larger target of victims.
Now, some believe that these figures are just the tip of the iceberg. One big problem when it comes to male sexual harassment is underreporting, as men are more hesitant to report incidents of harassment for fear of ridicule.
So we reached out to Dr. Anasoya Jagathesan, who is the Dean of Psychology and Social Sciences, University of Cyberjaya, to understand why men feel this hesitance.
Okay, why do men find it harder to report harassment? Firstly, there is a myth, and it is a huge myth, that men would find it complimentary or nice when a woman is interested in you and shows interest. And you think that if a woman is the boss and is, you know, showing interest in the guy, then it must be a compliment. It's not. It's harassment, especially when the man is married or they are, you know, they are not interested. They have a girlfriend. They have somebody else that they're interested in, or they have moral values which tells them that this is wrong. That's number one. So the first reason is basically that, you know, people assume that it is complimentary. And to get over that myth of it's a compliment is quite hard. Because, you know, when you go and tell some of your friends who don't understand, are not in your situation, they think, oh, what's a big deal? No, it is a big deal. It's a big deal because your job is threatened.
She also mentioned that men typically find it harder for their stories to be believed.
People find it a lot easier to believe when the victim is a girl. But they find it more difficult to believe when the victim is a guy. And here's the other side of not believing. Sometimes they themselves don't believe they're harassed. Sometimes they themselves don't realize they can be harassed and they can be put under pressure because nobody really talks about it as much as they talk about women's harassment. And always, you know, people are scared that they're going to be laughed at. People are scared that they're going to be mocked and looked down upon, you know, for making a complaint. And this is something that is part of the problem.
That was Dr. Anasuya Jagathevi Jagathasan, Dean of Psychology and Social Sciences at the University of Cyberjaya. Cam, I mean, this is, in fact, a serious matter, and the underreporting, because we see this underreporting in other fields of life as well, not just for men, but, you know, when underreporting happens, we don't get a true sense, I guess, of the problem.
Well, first of all, let's just remind ourselves that even with apparently a 600% increase, it is still 4% of the total, where men are the target. That leaves, my math is not very good, but that's 96% where it is women who are the target. So it's still not, you know, it's not overwhelming. But underreporting, I'm sure, happens even with women as much as it does with men. So the issue is, as the good doctor mentioned just now, it's about recognizing when it is happening and being able to speak up about it hopefully as soon as possible.
Yeah, and having those mechanisms and safe spaces or, you know, protocols in place so that the person can do it in a way that protects not just more than their identity, but protects their dignity. Well, if you have any thoughts on this story and the question of sexual harassment targeted at men, you can call 7733 2900. You can send us a voice note or a WhatsApp at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio.
Number four.
Flea market traders at Pasakarat asked to move.
There's been a lot of noise recently on this issue, with Bukit Bintang MP Fong Kwi Lun saying that the traders have to move to another more suitable area. He said that the back lane where they usually conduct their business is not conducive and that the area has now become an eyesore.
Now, I don't know if you're familiar with this area, Cam. I can't say I'm familiar, but I know it because I've walked past it.
Yeah, same here.
Say I'm familiar might suggest something else about my day job in relation to other jobs I might have. Okay, so the flea market, just to get everybody back on the page, was opened about two decades ago and is known for vintage goods, antiques and used items.
And it runs parallel to Petaling Street.
It does indeed run parallel to Petaling Street, behind those, you know, those shop houses. There were plans to transform it into an antique market back in 2015, but those plans fell through.
So back in the day, people called this the thieves' market because they believe many of the goods sold there were stolen. Mm. Now they sell items like cameras, badminton rackets, toys, shoes and thrifted clothing. Just so you know, DBKL issued the traders temporary business licenses in 2016, which have now expired.
Yeah, the word karat, of course, in Malay means rusty, but I think it also has a colloquial meaning of being just sort of, you know, part of the kind of debris of urban society. And it might refer to people as much as it refers to things. Now, the MP also said that the area is prone to traffic congestions and is a fire hazard. And it would be difficult for the fire and rescue department to use the back lane, which is not being used for the Pasakarat, in cases of emergencies because of the traders there. The MP said that DBKL will take action against the traders if they refuse to move.
Meanwhile, the traders have reportedly held meetings with the Kuala Lumpur City Hall, or DBKL, in a bid to allow them to stay put. They've asked DBKL to beautify the current location and turn it into a tourist attraction.
Right, so the Persatuan Penjaja Pasakarat Kuala Lumpur and Selangor chairman Abdul Rahman Ali said about 140 traders are concerned that their businesses will be reduced if they're forced to relocate.
Notices have been issued for them to vacate the area by the end of last year, and that's since passed. The plan was to have them carry out their business next to Lee Lam Thai wet market, but the traders didn't think it was a suitable spot.
No, did you know there was a market named after...
I did not.
Tan Sri Lee Lam Thai.
That's really recent, isn't it?
and fairly interesting. Okay, I wonder what they sell there. We reached out to Japing Lee, director of Pollen 8, for her thoughts on how we can address this particular problem.
The issue of the relocation is a complex one. If you ask me whether this type of pasar is needed, I would say definitely we need some sort of diversity in terms of product offering in a city. But the real question is, do we need it in this format?
So the issue with this format is that it creates many problems for access, especially for emergency vehicles. And the second issue that you see is the way the format is presented. So before we think about relocation, we should really dial back and perhaps think about who we're serving, who does this market serve, and how can we present it in a much more aesthetic way so that people have a better experience with this market.
That was Li Jiaping, urban rejuvenator and director of Pollen 8. Kind of weighing in on the Pasakarat issue. I know it, and I've known it for a long time, only because people have made reference to it. I'm too lazy to get up really early in the morning. But I think it now actually runs through much part of the day. I mean, for a better part of the day, so that, you know, if you're like me, too lazy to get up early in the morning, you can still access that area.
Yeah, and I thought I knew Petaling Street area. But I don't really know this market. But the thing with Botanic Street itself, the rejuvenation of almost gentrification of Botanic Street is remarkable. I never imagined it would happen, that there are now these cafes, etc., upscale restaurants in that area, living right next to still this particular market, the flea market. That's, to me, is amazing, and it long may it last. But, you know, progress is progress.
What, inevitable? I do think, though, that, you know, and what Jeping did mention was the question of offerings, right? What does the city offer, the diversity of the offerings? Mm. She seemed to be kind of agnostic about whether this had to stay. You know, the question is, if you want something like this, where best to place it? So let us know. Do you know Pasakara? Do you like to rummage about so-called thieves markets? You can call 7733-2900. Send us a voice note or WhatsApp at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. After the break, we're continuing our countdown for Top 5 at 5, BFM 89.9.
Bole for Malaysia. Ha. BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's 5:19 and you're listening to Top 5 at 5 with Sharad and Cam, where we count down to the biggest story of the day. Now, we started off with the story of an increased number of cases of sexual harassment targeting men, that's increased. But still, as Cammy pointed out, just 4% of the total number. Also, a flea market, namely a well-known Pasakara, being asked to move. And now,
number 3.
Mantega Terbang's director fails in his bid to lift a gag order on him.
Mohammad Kari Anwar Jalani, director of Mantega Terbang, has had appealed for the gag order's removal. But this morning, a three-person Court of Appeal bench unanimously denied his application. The court imposed a gag order on him on January 17th as part of his bail conditions in the trial of the controversial movie.
Now, the appellate bench's chairperson, Mohammad Zaidi Ibrahim, stated that the appeal has no merit as the film director did not demonstrate how the magistrate had made a mistake by including a gag order as a condition for bail.
Now, as you know, Mantega Terbang was banned last year after it received negative reactions from some quarters regarding its depiction of social attitudes toward Islam. In the film, the main protagonist, who is a young Muslim woman, started exploring the concept of rebirth in other religions and was not met with opposition. This is crucial here. Crucially, not met with opposition by her father. Because of this, Mohammad Kari Anwar is charged with intentionally hurting the religious feelings of others, to which he has pleaded not guilty.
Now, to understand Malaysia's continuing censorship of film and other art forms, we reach out to Zikri Rahman, a research fellow for Arts Equator's Southeast Asian Arts Censorship Database Project, for comment.
Looking at the nature of the case, of course, it will be a long, hard battle, but it also shows the tireless commitment from those who are willing to fight for our arts and cultural ecosystem. Indeed, it will be a pertinent legal precedent for the film industry player to come together in countering multiple nature of censorship in Malaysia. With the highest number of recorded censorship violations in Southeast Asia, with 245 cases from 2010 until 2022, the Mantega Terbang case definitely highlights how intertwined, structural and systemic the culture of censorship in Malaysia. Whether it is in the modes of repressive apparatuses in the form of multiple legislation, for example, the usage of Film Censorship Act and how deliberate certain section, such as the Section 298 Penal Code, that can be used to criminalize the cultural producer.
He also pointed out the influence of ideology and public sentiment on censorship.
It is also important for us to trace how ideological censorship violation can be, whether in different forms and ways of fundamentalism that unfolded in our country, be it in the religious or cultural norms. For Mantega Terbang itself, not only we see how different apparatuses work in tandem, it also highlights the emerging trends of public-based censorship in play and how involved the public in shaping the narrative for years to come.
That was Zikir Rahman. He's a research fellow at, or for rather, Arts Equator's Southeast Asian Art Censorship Database. Because speaking about a very important question, censorship and creativity and, you know, the long-standing forms of censorship that we've had in this country.
Well, we covered the story actually yesterday as well with a different movie. That movie, I think, was not really looking for a general release. It was quite happy to, I think, go online. This movie, clearly, it's really important to be able to get the general release. And if it's denied, then the whole financial backing is just in jeopardy.
Well, I understand Mantega Terbang actually got released on an OTT platform, right? This is, so it was not looking to go into the cinemas. Whatever it is, whether it's OTT or the general release, the question is, what do we want our country to be culturally? And do we want our creatives to constantly have to battle censorship? If you don't like a movie, why not just not watch it? Why do you call for its banning? And that's, I think, the kind of general social attitudes that are being, that are really preventing creatives from thinking of Malaysia as a place for which our stories can be told honestly and in interesting ways.
You sound like one of those liberals I've been reading about, aren't you? You are, aren't you?
Secretly. Okay. I don't know how you guessed. Okay. So let us know what you think about censorship in the country. Do you think it's going to be holding creative individuals back from doing their best work? Remember, you can call us 7733-2900. Send us a voice note or a WhatsApp at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio.
Number two.
Continuing the countdown to the top story, calls for Najib Razak's house arrest bid to be made public.
Several NGOs, including Bersih and the Centre for Independent Journalism, also known as CIJ, have urged for Najib's bid for house arrest to be conducted as open court proceedings. This comes as a response to the Kuala Lumpur High Court's decision to switch the proceedings to be held in the chamber.
Najib's lawyer, Muhammad Shafi Abdullah, stated that the switch was made because the application dealt with private court documents. With this change, the media will no longer be able to cover the lawsuit to make it known to the public.
Bersih and CIJ have both criticised the shift. Bersih stated that the case needs to be done openly and transparently due to the involvement of a high-profile individual. They added that if the case is done in a private manner, where its progress is undisclosed to the public, it will cause an erosion of confidence towards the government and judicial system.
So we reached out to lawyer Newson Yu for comment on this particular part of very interesting case.
Judicial review can be very technical that many lay people, including the NGOs, may not be familiar with. The NGOs, of course, raise very legitimate points on transparency and accountability, but I don't think anything sinister is at work here. There are two stages to a judicial review, the leave stage and the substantive stage. Only the leave stage is heard in chambers. The substantive stage is heard in open court.
He also explained the distinction between these two stages.
This stage, the leave stage, it's done ex parte, which means only the applicant and the attorney general is heard and not the defendant. And it's also done in chambers, which means privately in the judge's chambers. And the reason for this is that it was meant to be a quick hearing to filter out claims which might be frivolous or hopeless. The court don't go into depth on the merits of the case. And once you get past the first stage, there will be a full hearing on the merits. And this is called the substantive stage. At this stage, the hearing will be done in open court. And this is when the full case of the applicant and respondents are presented.
That was lawyer Niu Sin Yu on the issue of the switch in court proceedings for Najib Razak's house arrest bid. Now, if you have any thoughts on this question or this story, rather, you can call 7733-2900, send us a voice note or WhatsApp at 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio, BFM 89.9.
Bole for Malaysia. Ha. BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's 5:38 and this Top 5 at 5 with me, Sharad, and Cam, where we bring you the five biggest stories of the day at 5pm. Now, just a quick recap of the stories that we've done. Rising numbers of cases of sexual harassment involving men. Then we spoke about the Pasarkarat flea market being very likely to be relocated. Also, Mantaka Terbang, the film, controversial film, its director failing to lift a gag order on himself. And then we ended with the question of Najib Razak's bid for house arrest and whether it should be conducted in chambers or in open court. Now, Cam, there's actually been a number of messages here for the Pasarkarat story. Ku SK says, the Pasar could be relocated to Amkop Mall.
I love Amkop Mall. It's a fabulous place filled with not necessarily cheap sort of antique-y things and vinyl and Star Wars memorabilia and whatnot. But Amkop Mall is Amkop Mall. It's already full. It's private enterprise. You can't just push over like for like people over there. No, I mean there has to be a home found for the Pasarkarat people which is organically nearby and their own.
Yeah, so the question of being organic, I think, is very interesting. And Ku, I don't know if you'd agree with Cam on this, that in some ways, Pasarkarat gives that part of Kuala Lumpur its character, right? It's part of the mix. It harkens to an older time. And whether, in some sense, in a functional sense, yes, Amkop Mall could be a replacement in terms of location, but what would happen to the character of it? So we do have also this message from Mohamed Shani Abdullah, who writes, how come only the lane has become, that lane has become an issue for emergency access? Such traders are unable to pay commercial rentals for their trade premises. They provide a choice of a tourism attraction and they establish their market. Think City, which is a different organization, should handle this relocation.
Yeah, so Think City, an organization that's involved with reimagining the inner cities and other places too. I don't know how much these traders pay in terms of rentals. I really don't know, but I can't imagine it's very high. And sure, so if, let's say, they were forced to Amkop Mall, they could never afford to go there. And yet, you know, Patani Street, as I said, it's really a happening spot, and there are people coming to the area finally, especially on weekends. And it would be great if they had that alternative from the shishi, but also to the you know, badminton rackets and old bicycles.
Yeah, I think the question of options and diversity, definitely part of the Pasarkarat story. Well, we're going to continue our countdown, and now,
number one.
So on Wednesday, the government announced that it will not proceed with the Petaling Jaya Dispersal Link project, or PJD Link.
For PJ folk who know these things, PJD Link was the revived KIDEX project that also met the same fate.
Yeah, so we'll be speaking to a transport expert, Ramachandra Munyandi, about what happened and also, more importantly, what comes next with regard to the real problem of traffic and traffic flows, but also the reality that some neighbourhoods don't want elevated toll highway crashing right through them. So tell us what you think about this issue. You can call 7733 2900. You can send us a voice note or a WhatsApp at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio.
Bole for Malaysia. Ha. BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's 5:43 and you're listening to the Evening Edition with me, Sharad Kutan, and Cam Ruslan. We're up to number five in the top story, really, for today, which is the PJD Link project. It's been cancelled. The announcement was made by Communications Minister Fahmi Fazil, with the explanation that the decision followed the concessionaire's failure to fulfil 6 of the 11 conditions set by Putrajaya. Now, we, of course, have a lot of questions with regard not just the failure of this project, but what comes after. And to help us with that, we have on the line Ramachandra Munyandi, CEO and co-founder of Asia Mobility. Ram, thank you so much for speaking to us. Let me just begin with, you know, your initial reactions to the news of the cancellation.
Hi, Sharad. Thank you for having me on the show. definitely my initial reaction is one that I think is similarly shared across the public sphere, is the fact that it was kind of on off all the time, and now it's off because it didn't meet certain, you know, conditions. What those, you know, conditions are have not been made known. So there's still a lot of question marks as to why was it cancelled, right? What was the reason behind the cancellation? And what does this mean for, you know, future projects of similar nature? Is it going to have this big uncertainty always hanging about highway projects that we have really no idea about what's going on, and then finally find out that it's on or off? So I think I share, I think, very similar concerns and reaction as to most of the public out there.
So you're saying that we don't know the factors, but I'm just going to barrel down on this a little bit more. Do you think that, how do you understand that the factors that the federal or state institutions are looking for in trying to decide on projects like this? How does the government assess the needs for an expressway?
Yeah, so from what I understand, there is a National Highway Development Plan that spells out the need for highways in our urban areas over the next X number of years. So we have that as a physical document that I think is owned by the Ministry of Works, if I'm not wrong. And in that National Highway Development Plan, that serves as the blueprint for all future highways. And I think that's where PGD Link had its roots from, right? There is a requirement that has been studied and determined by, you know, perhaps, you know, city planners and town planners and, you know, traffic planners, that there is a need for such a highway in that area. And therefore, I think it comes from there. It comes from, you know, traffic studies. It comes from the need for city planners to start demarcating and, you know, setting aside land boundaries, for example, right, for new highways. And I think it comes from there. And then after that, when it comes towards, you know, planning for it and designing that highway, then that's where the highway concessionaire parties are involved, and they deal with the Ministry of Works in this case. That's when it starts the ball rolling in terms of a highway project that's being built. There needs to be some, you know, agreement with the federal government. And then, of course, land matters takes it down to the state. And so in this case with PGD Link, it started with a concession agreement with the Ministry of Works at the federal government level. And then once that has been achieved, they go down to planning and basically getting all the necessary approvals. And that requires state-level engagement, in this case, the state of Selangor. So, as part of that, you know, process, there are primarily three major impact assessment reports that are involved as a prerequisite for any highways to be developed and to be built. This is your social impact assessment, traffic impact assessment, and environmental impact assessment. So SIA, TIA, and EIA. So with your SIA, I believe that is under Plan Malaysia. With your TIA, I think that's the Ministry of Works. And then your EIA is the, you know, Jabatan Alam Sekitar, which is your, you know, natural land and environment, you know, department. So those are all the different agencies that are actually involved as they perform due diligence and as they look at the feasibility studies before a highway gets approved.
Ram, you know, often the public and activists included, and I kind of confess at this point, I was one of those affected parties with the PGD Link, that we often demonize the concession as, rather than look at the system as a whole, that created the needs for this particular kind of solution. I mean, if we're going to move forward in this conversation, how do we demarcate the system that you just outlined just now in all its complexities and the concessionaires that come in at any point in time in the life of that project?
Yeah, I think the nature of highways in particular, and it's actually not just highways in this case, it's any major public infrastructure projects, right? It's more common with highways where, because it's a toll collection, you know, project, there is, you know, revenue generating portion of that project versus, say, you know, building drains, you know, for example, right? You can't really, you know, collect revenue from drainage, but in this case, with a toll highway, you can. So that's where that whole concept of a concessionaire came into place, and that's where the public the, you know, public sector says we need a road here or we need infrastructure here, and then the private sector who's building it comes and more or less partners with the public, more or less partners with the government here, and say, sure, we'd like to meet your needs here. We'd like to fix this problem. We are going to build it, in some cases, finance it as well. As I understand, you know, PGD Link, that's where the, you know, concessionaire came in and says, we'll not just build it, we'll finance it as well. So if I'm not wrong, I think it's probably the first privately financed, in its entirety, highway project in Malaysia. So I think the concept of a public-private partnership, we can't run away from. I think it's positive, it's healthy, that the government does not bear all the risk of construction or financing some of these projects, right? So that funding can be channeled towards areas of immediate need, because it takes time to build a highway, and then you need to operate it, you need to maintain it. So that, you know, public-private partnership should be encouraged, should be fostered. But I think what needs to happen is a further refinement of the public-private partnership process, right? So which private partner should be qualified enough to enter into something like this? What is their social give back? What is the public impact out of this? And I feel that's where it's a bit skewed. So we want to see more sort of public-private partnerships go into place, but I don't think we are talking about two similar parties on both ends of the table being at the same level of capability, right? So I think we need to upscale the public side of engagement here with the private parties so that you've got experts on both sides of the table. And then on the private side, I think that we also need to raise the bar in terms of the expectations from the public, in terms of who these private partners are, who should be entitled to a long-term concessionaire, that will then meet the needs of the entire, you know, community and not just the needs of the project.
Well, speaking of the entire community, and indeed Sharad's concerns, perennial issue is that the PJ Link was initially proposed to help alleviate traffic problems in the city, but received a lot of pushback from Petaling Jaya residents. In major infrastructure development, there's always the question of the NIMBY. This is where Sharad comes in. They're not in my backyard. People who want the public services but don't want the facilities to be near them. How would you address not the case NIMBY, it's NISBY, not in Sharad's backyard, people.
It's throwing me under the bus, even before I get to the toll gate.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, that's human nature, right? I like to drive my car, I don't want the highway in front of my house. And I think you see this effect on many other public infrastructure projects, you know. I need a place to, you know, bury the dead, but I don't want to buy a house next to the cemetery, right? So I think it comes down to really urban planning, so that we can mitigate this. We won't be able to eliminate this. Some people are bound to find themselves caught in a situation where after they move in, something happens next to their house that is less desirable. But I think with, you know, efficient, systematic foresight in urban planning, we can help to really alleviate and not have these problems so much apparent in the future. So you can really only do this with new townships, right? Unfortunately, you know, PJ is an old town. You know, PJ, it's an old town. It's an old city. KL is an old city. So you've got to work with that. Some claims look, yeah, it's not in my own backyard, but if it's underground, it's okay, right? But underground costs significantly more than being something, over the land. So there's cost factor there. So we've got to balance all of this. I think urban areas require rejuvenation, right? I think it's unrealistic to expect that parts of your beloved city will stay the same forever. That's unrealistic. Especially if we talk about, you know, development and progress and growth. I think there are parts of PJ that are earmarked for huge redevelopment, rejuvenation, in fact, right? And with that comes a remodeling of your physical space, right? And that means houses that were there that were, you know, that were once, you know, single-story bungalow with a big land, now it's got a highway next to it. And that really means that really ceases to be a sustainable residential place anyway in the future, right? So there is that whole impact that we need to look at if things like this are going to be managed well, the impact to the person's backyard needs to be taken into account. And therefore, then you know, you've got to think about how we can repurpose our zones, how we can redesignate some of these residential areas, how we can move even some of the people to new places, right? Incentivize them to be able to give up their land at a good premium so that some new redevelopment can take place there, or maybe even a big nice park. You know, we all want to see nice parks in our backyard, but there's no space, right? So I think the not in my backyard problem, you know, presents an opportunity for us to reshape our city.
Yeah, Ram, you already kind of, you know, getting to the next question that I want to ask, because now that the project has been halted, I guess it is an opportunity for us to talk about alternatives, but it has to include, I guess, the problem that was set up for which the concessionaire provided a solution, now rejected, which is that you want traffic flow from one part of the city, not PJ, but I mean the whole kind of Klang Valley kind of level of city going across. I mean, what are the possible kind of alternatives now that we should be thinking about?
I think there are obviously a number of, you know, different options. So let me just share with the listeners here what's already happening in other parts of Malaysia. Let's take Sarawak, for example, right? They have committed to a major public transport infrastructure project called the Kuching Urban Transport System that's being built right now. It involves the use of a BRT type, which is what you see in Bandar Sunway, which is an elevated, dedicated lane for buses. But it's not using buses. It's using trackless trams, hydrogen-powered trackless trams, right? And that's really interesting. So they have found an alternative to your LRTs, to your light rail system, that's going to cost significantly less, but gives you the people moving capacity as an LRT. So let's just not look elsewhere. We don't need to look elsewhere for this. Just look just across the South China Sea to Sarawak. But that still requires the building of dedicated lanes. It still requires elevated roads. So you can't run away from having to have dedicated lanes or roads for this, right, at the very least. So I think with that comes a lot of other opportunities, right? So you want to be able to say, look, can we then maybe utilize some of the new services that, you know, for example, we have launched here with Asian Mobility, the, you know, startup that I lead. We are the pioneers of, you know, demand responsive transit system. And that's being able to use smaller capacity vehicles, anywhere between 15 to a 20 seater passenger van, but make it demand responsive, make it digital. So it's on demand. There's no fixed route, no fixed timetable, but that's for first and last mile services. I can run a long route service with that, right? That helps you take you from near your door to the station, right? And then from the station, you transfer on. So I think any new solution that we think of cannot be simply what line do we build or what sort of, you know, vehicle do we use. We got to think door to door. We got to think multimodal. We got to think about where the person is, where is their home, and how do they get to their final destination anywhere in the city. So we need to then connect anything that we build to existing services, existing transport systems. And so I think that actually opens up a lot of opportunities for us. But obviously, we need to be realistic, right? A lot of people say, look, I want public transport. But what they really mean is that I want LRT. But LRT is not the only mode of public transport. I would say we need to really still focus on ground transport, right? Stuff that runs on roads, because that's the easiest, fastest, most economical way in order to move vehicles and move people. And so buses must be a mainstay. Buses, but it's just that we need to reform what those buses look like. It doesn't need to be those big 12 you know, meter buses. We can use, you know, smaller shuttle vans. It needs to be digital, you know, demand responsive. We got to actually reform what buses are. And, you know, buses were the first form of modern public transport. It is still here and it will choose to be here. It will remain. So we need to really look at that seriously.
Ram, we have just 1 minute left, but you're talking now to our BFM listeners. What would you advise them to think in terms of how to rethink these difficult transport issues?
I think this entire preoccupation, let's just build something new to fix an old problem. I think we need to stop doing that. We need to fix what we can right now using existing infrastructure. Let's use a lot more data and technology to guide this. You know, going back to one of the earlier questions about how do governments plan this, I think we need to inject a lot of data-driven insights into this. We need to leverage mobility data and start building, you know, mobility patterns over our cities in real time. And that means now we know exactly where origin destination pockets are so that we can then really construct and optimize infrastructure spending in the most efficient way and use a lot more technology to do this. So no more empty runs, put a lot more smaller vehicles on the road and you create green waves, right? So we talk about smart traffic lights, a smart traffic light that will turn green as soon as it sees a van carrying 10 people coming, right? We can do that right now. It's just that we're not having the right conversations to do this.
Thank you so much, Ram, for speaking to us. That was Ramachandran Munyandi, CEO and co-founder of Asia Mobility, BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.